Sabbath as Resistance, Saying No to the Culture of Now, Walter Brueggemann. Chapter 6, Sabbath and the Tenth Commandment. The fourth commandment on Sabbath compels rest for all members of the household, all members of the community, human and animal. As such, it looks forward to the last six commandments that concern neighborly relations, Exodus 20, 12 through 17. The fourth commandment anticipates a peaceable household and neighborhood and sets out a discipline and limit that will serve that peaceableness. The six commandments that follow on neighborliness reach a climactic point in the tenth commandment on coveting that is presented, perhaps, as the act that is the ultimate destruction of the neighborhood. For coveting generates mistrust and sets neighbor against neighbor. That tenth commandment has very often been distinguished from the preceding commandments by suggesting that, unlike the others, it concerns only an intent or an attitude and not an act. Thus, unlike forcible actions of killing, committing adultery, or stealing, but that is almost surely a mistaken interpretation of the commandment. Coveting is understood in biblical tradition as including both an attitude of craving and forceful action to secure what is craved. It underscores the force of lustful desire, but knows that the danger to the community comes when the craving is acted upon. Thus, the commandment concerns a posture and practice of acquisitiveness and capacity and readiness to acquire what properly belongs to another, and so to place the well-being of the other in jeopardy. The specifics of such community-destroying greed include house and wife. House refers to the entire socioeconomic aggregate of a village household. In a patriarchal society, moreover, a wife may be reckoned as a principal property along with the house, not as an object, but as one who belongs to and belongs with the male head of the household. Beyond house and wife, the prohibition concerns the householder's means of production, that is, economic viability, slaves, ox, and donkey. It is prohibited to infringe economically on the well-being of others. After the prohibition of these named objects, house, wife, means of production, the commandment ends with a conclusion so sweeping that nothing is exempt from the rule: everything that belongs to your neighbor. What strikes one about this list is that in a very brief statement of prohibition, the term neighbor occurs three times. It is all about respecting the neighbor, so it is about preserving, honoring, and enhancing the neighborhood. It is most probable that the neighborhood in purview was an agrarian village of vulnerable peasants, each of whom lived a vulnerable economic existence with no margin for loss. For that reason, any disturbance of property arrangements had the potential of making life in the village unlivable. Thus, Sabbath rest in context means to protect the space and property of the neighbors from the restlessness that disrupts and skews social relationships by desisting from acquisitive practices. There is no doubt that the Torah, most particularly in the tradition of Deuteronomy, is concerned for neighbors, and especially the most vulnerable of neighbors, widows, orphans, and immigrants. These are the ones who are most vulnerable to economic interference, through which they may be reduced to helplessness, poverty, and a lack of viability. The commandment thus seems to be a quite particular rule concerning the love of neighbor, which Jesus subsequently identified as the second great commandment, Mark 12, 28 to 34. The neighbor is to be loved as self, and the property of the neighbor, his house, wife, means of production, are to be protected, even as one wants one owns house, wife, and means of production left undisturbed. As we have seen with the term Egypt in the first commandment, so the term housewife means of production in the 10th commandment plunges into socioeconomic concerns in which covenantal prohibition forbids the kind of economic free-for-all that might favor the rich and powerful against the poor and vulnerable. In context, moreover, this way of plotting the dynamics of social economic power likely reflects a recurring practice in that ancient world. These were agrarian peasants at the mercy of urban elites who were backed by and in solidarity with the power of the centralized city-state, the legitimacy of centralized temple worship, and the effective expertise of the scribal legal guild. If this social plot is described correctly as an uneven contest between agrarian peasants and urban elites, then one may imagine how vulnerable the rural peasants were with their small farms in the face of such coercive urban capacity. In contemporary analog, we might imagine the allied force of the state with its management of the economy by those who control the levers of government, corporate wealth and influence, legal sharpness, and the legitimating power of credentialed religion. In the face of such unequal power arrangements, the prohibition of the 10th commandment draws a line of protection which recognizes that such acquisitive power does indeed exist, but it must be curbed in the interest of the common good. It is most likely that the law of release in Deuteronomy 15, 1 to 18 reflects the reality of such unequal social power. In this provision, Moses summons Israel, surely the creditor class, to cancel debts on the poor and vulnerable at the end of 7 years in order that there should be no permanent underclass and to subordinate the economy to the common good. The sharp warning issued by Moses that the creditors should not be hard-hearted or tight-fisted indicates an ideological resistance to such a covenantal requirement and limitation, verse 8. Thus, the provision in Deuteronomy 15 is a counterpoint to the prohibition of the 10th commandment, both of which mean to curb the devouring power of entrenched economic force aimed against the vulnerable. We may cite a number of biblical texts that will serve to exposit the 10th commandment. 1 Kings 21, 1 through 29. The narrative account of the seizure of the property of Naboth by King Ahab and Queen Jezebel in 1 Kings 21 is paradigmatic for our commandment. The narrative is situated in the cycle of Elijah accounts so that we may anticipate that it has a critical perspective against entrenched royal power. Though the term covet is not used in the narrative, it well exposits the commandment. The drama reflects the map of socioeconomic power in that ancient world. Naboth is a small-time farmer whose land is his ancestral inheritance. It belongs to his family, even as he himself belongs to the land. The relationship of person and land is close and beyond question. The royal enterprise, by contrast, is fully emancipated from such ancestral notions of property and views all property as a tradable commodity. Thus, Ahab and Jezebel are an embodiment of an acquisitive worldview before which traditional claims are weak and malleable. Naboth resists the royal initiative only by reiterating his claim. But the royal couple, completely impervious to such claims, will stop at nothing until they are able to take possession of his ancestral heritage. This narrative makes clear that coveting is not only a desire for, but the active capacity to seize what one desires. It is no wonder that the narrative clash of economic systems evokes the ominous entry of Elijah, whose presence and words contradict the acquisitive effort of the royal party that he judges to be unsustainable, verses 17 to 24. Micah 2, 1 to 5. The oracle of Micah 2, 1 to 5 more explicitly comments on coveting. Micah is a spokesperson for the small agrarian peasant who engages as they are able in resistance against the urban elites in Jerusalem. See Jeremiah 26, 17 to 18. This oracle is organized around an initial alas or woe that anticipates deathly trouble, Micah 2, 2, a therefore of consequence, verse 3, and a climactic therefore, verse 5. The indictment in verses 1 to 2 speaks of plotting at night on their beds and performing the plot in the day, morning dawns. The two time slots, night and day, bespeak the power of desire and the power to secure what one desires. The plot and the performance of it are about coveting, seizing, taking away, and oppression. It is all about confiscation, and the object of such coercive desire is fields, houses, people, and inheritance. The terms are parallel to the themes of the Naboth narrative. The first two verses portray an economic enterprise in which the wicked are the rapacious urban land speculators who exploit the vulnerability of the peasants. We might think of the usurpers as urban developers who exercise the right of eminent domain, or bankers who foreclose on failed loans, or governments or church officials who know a prized location when they see it. Indeed, the poetry concerns the entire system that runs roughshod over the claims of inheritance. The initial, alas, voices the prophetic conviction that such confiscation in order to develop larger estates is a lethal, unsustainable enterprise. The therefore that follows introduces a poetic sketch of the eye of Yahweh, the guarantor of old ancestral inheritance, who will devise evil against the coveters who have, as they have devised in the first place. The devising of evil by Yahweh in response to their devising of evil will result in an evil time to come. It will be a time of utter ruin when the inheritance of my people, not just the little inheritances of the peasants, will be in shambles. The poetry in context anticipates the coming of the Assyrian armies, before which the urban elites in Jerusalem will be helpless. Thus, the poetry connects observable coveting practices and the anticipated external imperial threat. The connection of the one to the other is the work of the governance of Yahweh. The outcome will be that the self-aggrandizement of the coveters will be reduced to bitter lamentation, verse 4. The speculators now will watch helplessly as the invaders redistribute the land away from their aggressiveness. The final verse 5, introduced by yet another therefore, anticipates that when the meeting is held by the empire to reassign the land, the wicked speculators will not be admitted to the meeting. They will get nothing. The poem enacts a radical social intervention the poem enacts a radical social inversion evoked by Yahweh. The outcome is a repudiation of the policies of the coveters. For that reason, as the commandment enjoins, thou shall not. Isaiah 5, 8 through 10. The oracle in Micah has a close parallel in the poetic oracle of Isaiah 5, 8 to 10. This poetic segment also begins with woe, anticipating big trouble to come because of destructive social behavior. The indictment is against those who join house to house and field to field, exactly the language of the commandment and of the Micah oracle. The process consists of buying up the land of small peasant farmers in order to develop large estates. The vulnerable peasants are then removed from their land and denied a livelihood, and now coveters can bask in their newly secured isolated self-indulgence. The prophetic judgment pertains to such rural displacement in our time. The same crisis might refer to urban gentrification that dislocates the poor and the vulnerable. The poetry traces the destruction by acquisitiveness of a viable neighborly infrastructure. The introduction of the Lord of Hosts in verse 9 indicates that such a rapacious economic transaction does not go unnoticed. The inescapable outcome of such land dealing in the perspective of Yahweh is that such extravagances are unsustainable. In ways beyond explanation, the poetry declares a great reversal to come of what is both unsustainable and unacceptable, so that many large and beautiful houses will be destroyed and abandoned. Worse than that, the agricultural land that is no longer cared for by attentive peasants will simply fail to produce. One might imagine that such a prospect about loss of productivity constitutes an early warning concerning agribusiness that will eventually ruin the land by neglect. The prophetic oracle is, in sum, an exposition on the 10th commandment. The reasons thou shall not is that neither the human community nor the land can tolerate such abusive policies long. Deuteronomy 19, verse 14, Proverbs 22, verse 28, and 23 verses 10 to 11, the old ancestral inheritances were sustained by long fixed boundary lines, likely with fences and postmarkers that were taken as abiding givens. But the coveters chose in principle to disregard such old markers in the interests of greater profits. They no doubt did so with legal protections enacted by their elitist government, but the old ancestral inheritance would not yield so easily, because that tradition understood that violation of such boundaries would upend and disrupt the entire casting of social relationships. Thus, in both Torah and wisdom tradition, the moving of such boundary markers was prohibited as subset of the 10th commandment. You must not move our neighbor's boundary marker set up by former generations on the property that will be allocated to you in the land the Lord your God is giving you to possess. Deuteronomy 19, verse 14. Do not remove the ancient landmark that your ancestor set up, Proverbs 22, verse 28. Do not remove an ancient landmark or encroach on the fields of orphans, for their Redeemer is strong. He will plead their cause against you, Proverbs 23, 10 to 11. The 10th commandment is a safeguard for a certain way of organizing social power in the interests of the neighborhood. Such neighborliness is eroded and eventually destroyed when the unchecked acquisitiveness of the powerful preys on the vulnerable. Jeremiah 5, verse 22, 5, 26 to 28, 6, verse 13, 14, 30, verse 12, 15, and 8, 10 to 12, as the prophetic tradition moves closer to the culminating crisis of the destruction of Jerusalem, the poetic rhetoric of the prophetic tradition becomes more intense. The social analysis of Jeremiah's voices the crisis of inequity between scoundrels, 5, verse 26, who are great and rich, fat and sleek, who operate with treachery against the orphan and the needy, who are defenseless, verses 27 to 28. This sketch of social power concerns the force of an acquisitive economy in which the powerful want and take what the vulnerable have. These practices transgress the boundaries of the Creator, who provide a safe place for the life of all, verse 22. The scoundrels have crossed over these boundaries in their rapacious practices, verse 28. The 10th commandment is an effort to set a limit on such systemic greediness, but Jerusalem now hosts an economy in which such boundaries have collapsed. The outcome is an economic free-for-all with the rights of the needy completely disregarded. Thus, Jeremiah draws a concluding judgment on the transgressors. From the least to the greatest of them, everyone is greedy for unjust gain, and from prophet to priest, everyone deals falsely. Chapter 6, verse 13. The phrase greedy for unjust gain does not employ the wording of the 10th commandment, but the intent is the same. All have become predators and coveters. All is the same. All have skewed social relationships by dealing falsely. The urban leadership, from priest to prophet, all have disregarded the prohibition of the 10th commandment. In order to make such an acquisitive economy work, it is necessary to distinguish the true economy with the euphemisms of well-being that contradict the facts on the ground. They have treated the wound of my people carelessly, saying, peace, peace, when there is no peace, verse 14. The wound in the body politic is acute later on in chapter 30, verse 12, said to be incurable. But the wound is perforce denied by the use of political slogans and popular mantras. The ideology of exceptionalism in Jerusalem, a city named for Shalom, will override all such social suffering. Thus, under the banner of ideology, the practices of exploitive, acquisitive economy go unchecked. They remain unchecked, says the poet, except for the divine therefore of verse 15. In the meantime, an acquisitiveness that despises and degrades the vulnerable in its greed becomes shameless. They acted shamefully, they committed abomination, yet they were not ashamed. They did not know how to blush. Therefore, verse 15. This prophetic exposition of the 10th commandment is reiterated in chapter 8, verses 10 to 12, a repetition that suggests it has become a tag word for the advocates of the old social relationships that are to be restored. All these Old Testament texts attest to restless assertive cynicism in a community that is completely unaware of its own self-destructiveness, except for the few who remain grounded in the old covenantal tradition. Luke chapter 12, 13 to 14. The 10th commandment, of course, runs in Christian tradition towards the teaching of Jesus. In the parable of Luke 12, 13 to 34, Jesus summarizes the two ways that are as old as covenant and as poignant as the Naboth narrative in response to the man in dispute with his brother over the family inheritance. Jesus provides the pivot point of his instruction. Take care, be on your guard and against all kinds of greed, for one life does not consist in the abundance of possessions. This statement is a near parallel to the 10th commandment. In the NRSV, it is greed. In earlier rendering, it is covetousness. What follows is a scenario of the coveting man who, like the wicked in Micah 2, the land speculators in Isaiah 5, and the scoundrels in Jeremiah 5, devours the land and the houses of the vulnerable. The greedy man in the parable is a huge success in his own eyes, but contrary to his own estimate, he is destined for death in his self-deceiving foolishness. From his act of narrative imagination, Jesus draws instruction for his disciples. Do not be anxious, verse 22. Do not worry about commodity goods. It is implied that an acquisitive way of life leaves one in anxiety and not yet ever having enough and always needing more. Thus, discipleship in this teaching concerns a life alternative to acquisitiveness. The alternative is grounded in confidence that God provides what is needed as energy is redeployed to strive for his kingdom, verse 31. Jesus invites to alternative, even as the Sinai commandment hosts an alternative of covenantal neighborliness. It turns out that the implications of the 10th commandment were important in the recurring teaching of the apostolic church. It may be that such teaching was conventional and stylized. It is nonetheless remarkable that the import of the 10th commandment is at the center of such teaching. Early Christians were attentive to the ideology of acquisitiveness and compulsive power of greed. We may notice five such instances from the early epistles of the church. Paul includes the 10th commandment in his summary that culminates with the neighbor. The commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, and any other commandment are summed up in this word, love your neighbor as yourself, Romans 13, 9. Love of neighbor is alternative to acquisitiveness, see 129, 7, 7. In Ephesians 5, 3 to 5, greed is listed twice among the distractions to be avoided. But fornication and impurity of any kind or greed must not even be mentioned among you as it is proper among saints. Entirely out of place is obscene, silly, and vulgar talk, but instead let there be thanksgiving. Be sure of this, that no fornicator or impure person or anyone who is greedy, that is an idolater, has any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and of God. 5:3-5. The counter to such destructive conduct is thanksgiving. Such a teaching may suggest echoes of Luke 12. Acquisitiveness, among other vices, is the antithesis of thanksgiving, one based in possession, the other in gifts. In the parallel passage of Colossians 3, the point is the same. Put to death, therefore, whatever is in you is earthly, fornication, impurity, passion, evil, desire, and greed, which is idolatry, verse 5. The list, taken in sum, amounts to the old self. The writer knows that this cluster of practice always comes together. They are rooted in a sense of self that is immune to the truth of neighborliness. By contrast, the focus on neighborliness constitutes an embrace of a new life with a new set of practices. You have stripped off the old self with its practices and have clothed yourself in the new self, which is being renewed in the knowledge according to the image of the Creator, verses 9 to 10. The new self is situated in the midst of the neighbors, and new conduct is grounded in neighbor regard. As God's chosen one, holy and beloved, clothe yourselves with compassion, kindness and humility, meekness and patience. Bear with one another, and if anyone has a complaint against another, forgive each other. One will not fail to notice that the term forgive occurs twice. Perhaps a pivot point of the new life. If such forgiveness includes the forgiving of debts, it may include a contradiction of all the acquisitiveness that thrives on indebtedness. The vision of an alternative is central to the life of the emerging church, even when its mandates are as old as Sinai. James reflects on the disputes in the church grounded in cravings. Those conflicts and disputes among you, where do they come from? Do they not come from your cravings that are at war within you? You want something and you do not have it, so you commit murder. And you covet something and cannot obtain it, so you engage in disputes and conflicts. You do not have it because you do not ask. Chapter 4, 1-2. Cravings create conflict and dispute and disrupt the neighborhood. The accent on asking in verse 2 suggests an alternative to cravings that isn't a transaction of gift of asking and receiving. 2 Peter 2 voices a harangue against false prophets. Among the many indictments of them is this passionate characterization. They have eyes filled of adultery, insatiable for sin. They have enticed unsteady souls. They have hearts strained in greed, accursed children, verse 14. The rhetoric of adultery, insatiable, enticed suggests a notion that all of life is an object of conquest and exploitation. To be trained in greed means to reduce all of life to a tradable commodity. Clearly, the point of this diatribe is to urge and warn the church that it is to be otherwise engaged in a different set of practices. For this very reason, you must make every effort to support your faith with goodness, and goodness with knowledge, and knowledge with self-control, and self-control with endurance, and endurance with godliness, and godliness with mutual affection, and mutual affection with love. For if these things are yours and are increasing among you, they keep you from being effective, ineffective, and unfruitful in the knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ. This accumulated testimony from the earliest church leaves for us the task of drawing an obvious conclusion. Ours, like that ancient society of Israel, and like the context of the early church, offers a social script for social systems of coveting, acquisitiveness. Indeed, our consumer society is grounded in the generational artificial desires readily transposed into urgent needs. The always emerging new desires and new needs creates a restless striving that sets neighbor against neighbor in order to get ahead, to have an advantage, and to accumulate at the expense of the other. The power of such a compulsion to get, of course, negates neighborly possibility. Beyond one-to-one transaction, this capacity for acquisitiveness is front and center in our public life and in the formation of public policy. We are able to watch while adherence to the common good disappears into a rhetoric of opportunity that simply means to deregulate society so predatory acts by those with leverage and will do so go unchecked. When coveting is systematic, as it is among us, one must ask about restraint and resistance to such policy formation and social practice. Such restraint takes the form of regulation, and it is possible to see that the 10th commandment is exactly such an act of regulation in the community of covenant-imposed restraint. But such regulation becomes exceedingly difficult when the ideology of greed permeates the very fabric of common life. This is, in such an environment, little will for such restraint. We are left, I suggest, with the question of how to break the lethal cycle of acquisitiveness. And so, in the context of our more general discussion, I wish to situate the 10th commandment in the context of the 4th commandment on Sabbath. Sabbath is the practical ground for breaking the power of acquisitiveness and for creating a public will for an assent on restraint. Sabbath is the cessation of widely shared practices of acquisitiveness. It provides time, space, energy, and imagination for coming to the ultimate recognition that more commodities, which may be acquired in the rough and ready of daily economics, finally do not satisfy. Sabbath is variously restraint, withdrawal, or divestment from the concrete practices of society that specialize in anxiety. Sabbath is an antidote to anxiety that both derives from our cravings and in turn feeds those cravings for more. Sabbath is an arena in which to recognize that we live by gift and not by possession, that we are satisfied by relationships of attentive fidelity and not by amassing commodities. We know in the gospel traditions that we may indeed gain the whole world and lose our souls, Mark 8:34-37. Thus, Sabbath is soul receiving when we are in a posture of receptivity before our Father who knows we need them, Luke 12:30. At the end of our reflection, we may consider the ways in which the Sabbath commandment occupies a pivotal space in the sum of the commandments. At the outset, we discern that the Sabbath commandment looks back to the emancipating God of the Exodus, who delivered from the restless productivity of Pharaoh and who rests on the seventh day. We observe that the Sabbath commandment looks forward to a possible neighborliness in which striving for commodities and community-destroying ways is prohibited. Thus, the fourth commandment reaches back to commandments 1 and forward to commandment 10. The two commandments 1 and 10 come together in startling interpretation, no doubt in the wake of rabbinic awareness. Be sure of this, that no fornicator or impure person or one who is greedy, that is an idolater, has any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and of God, Ephesians 5:5. Put to death, therefore, whatever in you that is earthly, fornication, impurity, passion, evil, desire, and greed, which is idolatry, Colossians 3:5. Almost incidentally and without calling attention to it, these testimonies identify idolatry that is rejected in commandment 1 and greed that is rejected in commandment 10. The two, idolatry and greed, are equated with both of them reduced livable reality to commodity. Idolatry is the worship overvaluing of things, especially things cast in gold and silver. A tree from the forest is cut down and worked with an axe by the hands of an artisan. People deck it with silver and gold. They fasten it with hammer and nails so that it cannot move. Their idols are like scarecrows in a cucumber field, and they cannot speak. They have to be carried, for they cannot walk. Do not be afraid of them, for they cannot do evil, nor is it in them to do good. Jeremiah 10:3-5. Coveting at the other end of the Decalogue consists in the pursuit of a commodity at the expense of the neighbor. Sabbath is a big no for both. It is no to the worship of commodity. It is no to the pursuit of commodity. But it is more than no. Sabbath is a regular, disciplined, visible, concrete yes to the neighborly reality of the community beloved by God. We used to sing the hymn, "Take time to be holy," but perhaps we should be singing, "Take time to be human," or finally, "Take time." Sabbath is taking time, time to be holy, time to be human. Psalm 73, my final text, is a report on a journey from the world of commodity to the world of communion. In verses 2 to 16, the psalmist ruminates over the seduction of the wicked. The wicked are prosperous, verse 3, not in trouble, verse 5, proud, verse 6, well-fed and well-entertained, verse 7, cynical and socially indifferent, verse 8, treated like celebrities, verse 10, defiant before and dismissive of God, verse 11, and rich and at ease, verse 12. Not bad, so says the psalmist. He is much attracted to such a life and thinks to enlist in it until he reflects, verse 15, until he goes to the sanctuary, verse 17, until he comes to know that such a way of the world has no staying power, verses 18 to 19, until he discovers that he himself was simply obdurate, verse 21 to 22. And then the psalmist utters his big nevertheless, that in Hebrew is only a conjunction with an emphatic pronoun, verse 23. Now everything is changed and differently perceived. Now the psalmist asks a different question. Whom have I in heaven but you? Verse 25a. Answer, no one. I have no other. The parallel line is not a question, but a verdict of settled reality. And there is nothing on earth that I desire other than you, verse 25b. It is the psalmist recognizes a question of desire. The psalmist comes to an acute awareness of the true desire of his life. He discovers that in that moment, that the life described in verses 2 to 16 consists of phony desires generated by an ersatz culture. Now he knows better and wants only to be near God, verse 28. It occurs to me that Sabbath is a school for our desires, an exposing critique of the false desires that focus on idolatry and greed that have immense power for us. When we do not pause for Sabbath, these false desires take power over us. But Sabbath is the chance for self-embrace of our true identity. I finish with a pause at verse 23. Nevertheless, I am continually with you. You hold my right hand. I recently heard a Lutheran pastor describe a woman who had walked 700 miles as a refugee to escape a violent war and was finally able to cross a national boundary out of the war zone. She walked all that way and brought with her an 8-year-old girl who had walked beside her. For 700 miles, the child held her hand tightly. When they reached the safety, the girl loosened her grip, and the woman looked at her hand. It was raw and bloody with an open wound. Because the little girl was held on tightly in her fearfulness, it is like that in verse 23. Nevertheless, I am continually with you. You hold my right hand. This is no casual handholding. This is a life or death grip that does not let go. No Sabbath existence imagines getting through on our own, surrounded by commodities to accumulate and before which to bow down. But a commodity cannot hold one's hand. Only late does the psalmist come to know otherwise. Only late may we also come to know. May we come to know, but likely not without Sabbath, a rest rooted in God's own restfulness and extended to our neighbors, who we also must rest. We, with our hurts, fears, and exhaustion, are left restless until then.